Thank you.
Thank you very much. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening to everyone. This is the IRTP Part B working group meeting of the 2nd of March. On today's call, we have Michaela Nyland, Michael Connor, Michael Collins, James Bedell, Paul Diaz, Kevin Erdman, Barry Cobb, Barbara Seal, Anil George, and for staff, we have David Giza, Olaf Nordling, and myself, Marika Konings. We have apologies from Eric Brown and Gisela Gruber-White. Over to you, Michaela.
All right, thank you, everybody. Good afternoon. You should all have got a copy of today's wonderfully exciting schedule. Let's have a look. Where's the schedule? It's like it was sent around, and I'm being terribly disorganized. Okay, roll call, John. Update. The sub-team, there's a small sub-team of us, myself, Mikey, Paul Diaz, and James. So, Paul, could you be so good as to give a very brief update on where things stand, please?
Thanks for putting me on the spot, bud.
Well, you're welcome.
Things stand.
Anytime.
Where things stand. This little team, we're in the process of putting together some thoughts to address a gap that we've recognized in the course of the working group, the gap being trying to come up with a quick, effective way to restore name that has been in some way improperly transferred. We're still ironing out the details, so we ask the group, give us a little more time. We will have something to talk about, something to present to the group and talk about, probably in the first call after the Nairobi meeting.
Okay, thank you, Paul. Does anybody have any questions about this or any queries or any other comments, thoughts? Don't all rush. No? Okay. Right then, moving on. We're continuing to look at the constituency statements. And since I have the memory of a goldfish, I rely on Marika. Marika, where were we at on this?
I think we were on page 5, issue D, comments number 2.
Okay.
Although I think the discussion covered to a certain extent already as well, comment 2 and 3, where I think on the one hand, registry constituent was saying we don't need any standards, and IBC and BC were saying, well, standards might be a good idea, and I think we started already discussing both sides of the argument. So.
Right. Oh, we were also looking a bit at this entire thing about EPP statuses, and I think that's where we kind of got into a tangle, because as somebody pointed out in one of the comments somewhere else, the document refers to a register lock status, which doesn't actually exist. I mean, it did exist in the past, but it doesn't exist anymore. That's a correct summation, or does somebody disagree? No? Thoughts? Okay, fine. Right. Okay, then. I think we're going to come back a bit to some of the stuff with regards to the lock statuses in a meeting sometime after Nairobi. We were looking at trying to talk to somebody about EPP. Is that correct, Marika?
This is Marika. The suggestion I made in an email to Michaela is that in the IRTP Part A working group, we had a presentation by, I think, a colleague from Barbara, from VeriSign, who actually wrote the protocol for EPP that gave us a bit of an explanation of how EPP works, what is and what isn't possible. And one suggestion was to see whether he would be willing and available maybe to talk to us about this specific issue in relation to registrar lock, and as well the suggestion that has been made whether status updates can be linked to the different lock statuses as having a more a clearer way of indicating to registrants what is going on. So that was a suggestion, and I see Barbara has raised her hand, so I'm sure she'll be commenting to that.
Okay, James, and then Barbara.
I'll defer to Barbara. She may cover my questions.
Okay.
I was just going to say that it was Scott Hollenbeck who had joined the working group in the past to help explain some of these things, and I'm sure with appropriate advance notice he would be more than happy to make himself available to answer any additional questions that we may have.
Barbara, since he works for the same company as yourself, would you be able to ping him on our behalf, please?
Of course.
Thank you. That'd be very helpful. James.
Hi, Michele. I just wanted to get something out on the record here. I am very respectful of EPP as the industry standard method of provisioning, and I think it's a genius as to how it is extensible. But I understand that that's even making a minor modification to it, it's no small undertaking. But we said something earlier about what is possible and what is not possible under EPP, and I'd just like to get out there onto the record that EPP is a tool for implementing the policies that are decided in this group and other ICANN groups, and if the tool needs to bend or change or modify to fit the policy, then so be it. We shouldn't be bending policy around tools, and I just wanted to get that on the record.
Am I going to put myself on the queue? Does anybody else have any other thoughts on this? Chair hat off, my own hat as registrar on. I would agree 110% with James. EPP is extensible. It's part of the bloody acronym's definition. So if we need to extend it so that it suits so it works with the policy, then so be it. I'm sick of all these sacred cows. Anybody else have any other thoughts on that? No? Okay.
Kelly, just look, you gotta give us a little bit of time for the mute button there.
Sorry?
I said just give me one more second for a mute button before you move on. I just wanted to say I agree, and, I think that we need to be cognizant that it is sometimes that there are time, costs, and development resources involved if we want to make any or recommend any changes that would affect EPP, but it shouldn't be a showstopper, so...
I'll put myself back in on this. But who was that was just speaking? Was that Paul or James?
That was James.
Sorry, James. Okay. One thing that is coming back, James, is that just being this, and Barbara, please don't be offended, the registries have a charming habit of informing the registrars when they make it a technical change, but we don't really have any option about implementing it. So, you know, it's a two-way street. Okay, moving on. Issue E. Whether and if so, how to best clarify denial reason number 7, a domain was already in lock status, provided that the registrar provides a readily accessible and reasonable means for the registered name holder to remove the lock status. And the registry it is recommended that to provide a consistent user experience, registrars use the EPP statuses to lock domains. I don't actually understand that comment because that seems to be self-evident. Or does that mean that it's not clear in who it is? Barbara, please go ahead.
It's basically just that I believe it's client prohibited statuses are used to lock the various types of transactions, whether it be client update, client delete, client transfer, prohibited statuses. So I don't know if there are other mechanisms available by which registrars are using, I guess, locked domain names, but it's basically that we would want them to be consistent in everybody using the EPP statuses versus, I guess, in-house versions to lock domain names, if that's possible even.
Okay. James, thoughts?
Yeah, the thoughts would be that as a registrar, and I'm not sure if this is universal or just true of ourselves, is that we tend to not, through our control interfaces, break down the lock function into those individual client-prohibited statuses. Rather, we just have a single lock on-off type of a switch, and that is kind of maps to all client statuses are then locked from that. I think that Barbara, you're correct. There's also probably this meta lock that is a flag that exists only at the registrar level and is not submitted to or set at the registry, and that would then cause the registrar to automatically NAC any transfer request if that flag is set. So, I'd be interested in hearing if they're willing to discuss how other registrars implement this locking function and whether it's something that's, and here comes the nasty word uniform again, but I just want to understand if they're doing something similar.
Okay. Mass, go ahead.
Thanks, Michele. Yeah, James, just to sort of pick up on what you said, I don't know how uniform the user experience is per se, but I from my experience, I would say that you're correct and that most registrars, including ourselves, have a simple lock or unlock. We don't necessarily break it down to the client delete, client transfer, client renew, client update prohibited level. And based on my experience dealing with most of the other registrars that I have, I would say that that's pretty consistent across the industry, is that it's either locked or unlocked. Now, the user experience may be different, you know, from GoDaddy to MarkMonitor to Network Solutions and how you go about locking or unlocking, but my experience is that it's just sort of that one singular notion of locked or unlocked.
Okay. One thing I would say here is that this could also have an impact on, say, for example, a registrar that has locked the domain on their back end, but they're not actually putting it in the Whois that it is locked. Because we've run into that issue several times in the past, and it's very, very annoying. In other words, any request to transfer the domain will get denied by the losing registrar, but Whois shows that the domain is not locked. So it's not very clear to anybody that there is a problem with the transfer. Barbara, then James.
I guess the question that I was going to ask is, it almost sounds as though GoDaddy, while they have one flag, if you will, that they flip, but that flag actually does map to the EPP statuses. I was just wondering if what Matt was describing also, in essence, maps to the EPP statuses, or if it's more like what you're describing, Michele, where there's really no indication in the Whois to show that it is in a locked status.
Okay. James, then Paul, then Matt.
I want to answer Barbara's question, but I'm not sure I understood what specifically she was asking. So can you repeat that, Barbara?
Basically, it sounded like you have a flag that you set, but I think that I heard that you had indicated that flag actually does end up mapping to the client prohibited statuses to lock the name down for EPP?
That's correct.
Okay. So that's, you know, what I was trying to confirm is whether or not, you know, the mechanism that Matt also described is that same situation, or if it's more like what Michele was describing, where there's some way that they're able to lock it at the registrar level, but there's no indication anywhere, and so there's confusion as to why the transfer is not going through because nobody can really see that it's locked in any of the Whois records or data.
James?
I would have to let Matt answer if that is also his experience. I understood his statement to mean that it was, but I don't want to speak for him.
Yeah, I can, Michele, if you're okay with that, I can just jump
yeah,
in
work
and pick up on Barbara. Okay. Yeah, so Barbara, for us, our lock statuses do map directly to the registry. So to us, the locks, if a name is locked in our system, it's client delete prohibited, client transfer prohibited, and client update prohibited. So there is no notion of, at least in our system, that someone locks a name and it doesn't actually push out through EPP to the registry. But I think an interesting point to note is that different registrars have different meanings of lock. So I may lock a name at a different registrar, and they may not put on those three statuses. They may just put client transfer prohibited.
Sure.
So that is where I don't think there's really any standardization. But yeah, for us, we don't have any notion of a lock that doesn't actually get pushed out to the registry.
Okay, thanks.
James?
Well, I had a thought on another subject, and before going off on that, if you don't mind, I'd like to turn it over to Paul and see if he's on this same subject. Or.
Okay.
Yeah, Paul. Thanks, James. Exactly. I just wanted to weigh in. Just like Matt and James, our organization, everything does map, and wanted to follow up on what others have said, that we experience the frustration that there are registrars out there that have some form of internal procedure they call a lock. It does not appear in EPP. It does not appear in the Whois. it is a major source of frustration and confusion. And it's something that, you know, we feel is a good thing for this working group to be looking at. It seems most of the major players, you know, have a straightforward, easy to understand, easy to verify process they use in instituting, using the lock, using the existing protocol. And, you know, for these folks that are operating sort of on the side with a one-off mechanism that is not, there's no way to see it in advance, and therefore creates all the confusion and customer frustration. You know, we feel that it's appropriate for the working group to look at those practices and to think long and hard whether that's an appropriate thing to allow.
If I could take my real turn now, McKelly.
Maybe. I'm thinking about it. I might let Mikey go first, so that would make you wait for 10 minutes. But I'll go on. I'll let you off this time.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to mention that this is about to get a little bit, possibly a little bit more complicated with the implementation of, through our step of allowing registrars to activate or deactivate server-side locks as well. And I don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves, but if we're detecting that there's some inconsistency now that's, as Paul mentioned, is disrupting transfer operations, there's a possibility that that could become even a little more confusing for registrants as registrars build products around registry locks, server-side locks, and as more and more registries adopt that through RCEP.
Okay. Mikey?
10 minutes. I resemble
okay.
that remark.
Yeah, you do. You do really resemble it. Oh, sorry. Did I say that loud? Damn.
Sorry. People. My observation is that we have really sort of two topics here. I think. I think that this last discussion is great, and I hope that we can capture the sentiment, and I'm on board with all of it. But the issue E is really about, or at least when the last time we looked at it long ago, was really about the consistency of the mechanism for the registered name holder to remove the lock. And so we may want to fork this discussion and capture the sort of technical consistency issues that we've been talking about, but also not lose sight of the need for essentially a user-facing, a registrant-facing, consistent way to remove the lock as well. And that's less than 10 dang minutes.
I'm very impressed with you, Mikey. You're restraining yourself. Does anybody else have any thoughts on that? Okay. Let's have a look, move along. Oh, wait a second. We have movement. Paul?
Yeah, thanks, McKaylee. I was just going to ask, and David's here, this issue E, wouldn't this ultimately become a compliance issue in that, you know, the policy very clearly states that the readily accessible and reasonable means to remove the lock status if a registrant feels that the registrar is not providing that reasonable means, then there's an escalation path to ICANN compliance, right?
Correct, there is. And typically
Dave Giza speaking, please, for transcription.
Yep. Yeah, Dave Giza speaking. The answer is yes, that's correct. And usually the escalation path starts either through the consumer complaint system, or it comes to us directly through an email or some other form of contact by an aggrieved registrant.
Okay. Marika?
This is Marika. Because I have a question, and Dave, how do you then interpret it readily accessible and reasonable? I guess that's the key question relating to this charter question. Where do you draw the line? Because I understand there's no definition in the policy that defines what should be considered accessible and reasonable. So how do you go about that, and is that something you would like to have more clarity around those concepts, and maybe that's something you would like this group to provide some more guidance on, or you have a very clear approach into what you consider, yes, you're right in your complaint, and no, this is not, you don't have any right to complain, basically.
This is Dave again. Unfortunately, the investigative work we do is case by case, and so there is not a clear standard on, what constitutes readily accessible and reasonable. And so if this group were to take it upon itself to try and define that term, that would provide some guidance for our compliance team as we investigate these instances. But right now it's really fact based, and it largely depends on how much information we get from the complainant before we can begin to assess if there's a legitimate basis for that complaint or not. So I can't give you a cut and dry answer, because there really is no definition around those terms today. It's really a question of judgment.
Mikey?
This is just to amplify David's point. I think that's the reason that this issue is on our list, is how to best clarify that. And that's the only thing I was trying to bring up, is that I think that we may want to fork this discussion into a discussion about that and another discussion about the technical issues that we were, the essentially operational issues that we were talking about just before. I think both of them are very important.
Okay. Let's deal with, with respect to the technical issues in terms of the EPP and everything else, Barbara is going to be asking her colleague if he can give us a bit of his time to go through some of this stuff with us. So maybe it would be appropriate to look at the Barbara, go ahead.
This is Barbara. I was just going to ask if y'all are going to be meeting next week in Nairobi, or if we would be taking next week off, and when I should ask him to join us.
Oh, sorry. I don't think we're planning on meeting next week, are we? Unless I've lost my mind and agreed to something. Does anybody want to meet next week desperately?
Michaela, we can't, because next Tuesday is constituency day, so.
Oh, yeah, there we go. Perfect. Thank you. Perfect cop-out. Thank you, Paul. There, we have a cop out, because next Tuesday is constituency day, so we're off the hook. Perfect. Thank you, Paul. I owe you a beer.
So, 16th then?
Potentially, yes, if he was available.
Okay.
I mean, ultimately, it's whenever he's available, whichever Tuesday, and then we can work from there. The discussion, just going back to this thing about reasonable means for the registered name holder to remove the lock status. Does anybody have any thoughts on what reasonable means is or isn't? Okay. I would appreciate if somebody is Chris Chaplow on the call? He's not, is he? He's not, okay.
No,
Marika, go ahead.
This is Marika. I was just actually going to point to the next two comments where I think some suggestions are being made as to what might consist of reasonable. I think the second comment from the registry suggests that terms and conditions should be included in the registration agreement. And they've also provided some specific language for denial reason 7 to reflect that. I'll post the actual new language in the chat so everyone can see it.
Thank you, Marika. James?
Hi, Michele. This is James speaking, and just wanted to state that if we are going to define reasonable means, we should make sure that we are not impeding registrars' abilities to develop security products against unwarranted transfers, for example, PIN numbers or callback systems or whatever else is out there. This is a value-added security feature, and it shouldn't be construed that adding different identity checks and things like that would be considered unreasonable. So I just would want to make sure that we have any kind of a definition that we would put into this term to help compliance, that we would ensure that we were leaving sufficient leeway for those types of services.
Okay. David, as this concerns you directly, do you have any comment to make on that?
None other than the fact that I think if there was a laundry list of items in an effort to define, you know, different options or variables that collectively represent a, you know, this definition of reasonableness, that that would give contractual compliance flexibility to work with registrars and registrants to you know, to determine if you know, if we've got a legitimate basis here for a complaint or not. So I'm really open to the suggestions of the group, and I really wouldn't want to preempt any of the group's thinking, you know, by suggesting, you know, a very narrow definition. But I would much more favor a broad definition with some examples. Again, that provides a, you know, a bit of flexibility, but also you know, begins to rein in, you know, sort of the either ends of the spectrum where, you know, judgment can go awry, you know, due to some very unusual fact pattern. So I'm really curious to hear what the other registrars on the call have to say about this.
Okay, thank you, Michael. Then Mass.
Yeah, this is Michael. I'm also interested in what the other registrars have to say. I think to define this without having it be somewhat subjective, but I think that generally it should not be harder to remove the registrar lock than it is to make change to the registrant or maybe changes to the DNS settings. I mean, I think that it should be similarly a program so that it's not any harder than other typical changes to a registration, or maybe even as simple as registering a domain name. And but I'm also concerned, I don't know if this is the right time to mention, I was just reading the text in the chat, and it says that registrar must facilitate removing the lock within 5 calendar days of receiving a request. That seems like an unreasonably long period of time to me. That's my personal thoughts on that. Thank you.
Matt?
Thanks. So just to pick up on what Michael was saying, and then to circle back around to actually what James started off by saying, is that, you know, I'm a little hesitant to say that unlocking a name should be as simple or as straightforward as anything else, frankly, because it's making an assumption that every registrar treats all of those actions the same. And again, to circle back around to James's point, that's not necessarily the case. And, you know, security features are definite market differentiators in this industry. And so I think, you know, James makes a good point, and certainly representing a registrar that likes to pride itself as, you know, differentiating based on security, we also have a different client base than a lot of the registrars out there, that I'd be really hesitant to say across the board, you know, a lock should be as simple as registering a name or should be as simple as updating registrant, because that to me isn't necessarily the measure. Registrars should be able to have different levels of security based on their clients' preferences and choices. And so I think we need to be really careful about any recommendations that we would make that limit a registrar's ability to do that.
Thank you. I put myself in the queue. To be perfectly honest, this thing about unlocking a domain is something which people should not enter into lightly. It opens up a domain to all sorts of issues and problems at multiple levels, including the domain being hijacked, somebody doing something nasty with the domain, and I would strongly disagree that it should be as easy as changing name servers I'd agree in broad terms with what Matt was saying. I mean, I think the registrants should have the ability to unlock the domain name, but if an extra degree of validation and everything else needs to be taken, then it has to be taken. I'll give you one clear, concrete example why unlocking a domain easily is a bad idea. DROA, Domain Registry of America. I'm sure some of you have come across them. What is that beeping? Mikey?
This is Mikey. I agree. I think that we're all sort of in the same place. The reason for this particular issue is mostly to overcome the problem of an unresponsive registrar making it hard for a registrant to unlock the name.
How would you classify unresponsive? I mean, what?
Oh, I don't
what
know.
What constitutes unresponsive?
I leave that to folks like Michael Collins, who does this a lot more than me, to describe. You know, I don't have a quantitative hurdle, but I think that the real point of this issue is not to flatten or make all registrars uniform in terms of how they handle security, but rather to address registrars that are just holding back the name. And that if we can come up with a definition that accomplishes that, but leaves security choices up to registrars, that we're in good shape.
Okay. Anybody else have any thoughts on that? Badouin Shum has joined the call. Does anybody have any other thoughts on this? I mean, okay, what... Just a question to all of you. You've all had problems with what has been termed often as unresponsive registrars. What do you consider to be unresponsive? I mean, is it one day, 2 days, 3 days, 5 days, a week, 2 weeks? At what point do you consider the registrar to be unresponsive? Paul Diaz?
Thanks, Michele. Look, from the perspective of a registrar, if we're working on behalf of a registrant, for us, unresponsive is so simple. They don't answer any email and they don't pick up the phone. Unfortunately, that happens, and we do then have to escalate it up to ICANN. It's very frustrating to have to drag ICANN into something as what should be as straightforward as that initial level of contact.
Well, the question is this. You're saying that the registrar does not answer the emails. Now, but how long are you allowing before you consider that the email is unanswered and is not going to be answered, is what I'm asking.
Oh, in some cases, Michele, I'm talking about bounced emails and no working phone number.
Okay.
We deal with those extremes, and unfortunately, it's not uncommon.
Okay, fair enough. Chris, Matt, and and I'll probably let James in as well. He hasn't put his hand up, but he's making noises by putting ticks and things. I'll expect something. Chris, go ahead.
Hi there. Yes. I think there's probably different levels, isn't it, just from a natural point of view. No response at all, you know, certainly by 24 or 48 working day hours to me. And then the second would be some sort of response, but no action at all, isn't there? You know, yeah, we'll look into it. Yes, we'll look into it. And at some point when that goes on for a period of time, I imagine, that would then reach the point at which the registrant feels they're just not getting anywhere. So maybe we're looking at two levels on this. Thanks.
Okay, perfect. Matt?
Yeah, so just to pick up on what Paul said, and I don't want to spend a whole lot of time on it, but, you know, we certainly do run into situations where, you know, where an unresponsive registrar, and again, it's not the folks that are participating in this process, the folks that are on this call, it's the outliers out there that, you know, to Paul's point, emails bounce, there's no phone number, or the email just goes unanswered, you know, for days, if not weeks, if not longer. So I agree with, and I apologize, I forget whose comment it was earlier, but, you know, if we can come up with some sort of standard that helps to address that while not, you know, tying the hands of registrars that want to have, you know, enhanced security, then I'm in support of stuff like that.
Okay. Michael Collins?
I certainly have listened and accept that there's a need for increased security, especially with extremely valuable domain names. And I would appreciate if I had that type of domain name, like at one time I did, that I had a means at my registrar to provide extra security for it. So I think that there is a need for both. But I would suggest that these extra security optional measures should be clearly entered into. They should not be just buried into a user agreement or a registrant contract such that you're allowing registrars to automatically add security features that a registrant might not understand. I think if they were optional and they were opted in, I would be all for it. I'd be excited about it. Thank you.
Okay. Chris Chaplow? Was that from
Sorry, yes, it was up from before, sorry.
That's okay. David Geiser, then James Bladel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just wanted to make sure the group was aware that contractual compliance is actually now taking a different enforcement approach around the around removing the lock within 5 calendar days. And so for those registrars that are the outliers, the ones who we've received a more significant number of complaints, we've developed a breach letter that we've sent now to about half a dozen registrars in an effort to get them to comply with the policy. And I'd say 3 out of 6 registrars have responded affirmatively and have resolved the situation. The other 3 are still in limbo at the moment. But we're attempting to enforce the policy here, you know, around the 5 calendar day requirement, and then we're going to collect that data and see what success we have. And you know, I'd be happy to, you know, provide the group with more information as we get a little further into this enforcement exercise.
Okay, thank you, James.
Hi, McKelly. This is James speaking, and I wanted to just real quickly address Michael's point about any additional security being an opt-in. I believe it was Michael that raised that question, and I agree completely. It should be very conspicuous and require action on the part of the, if not agreement, but some sort of action on the part of the registrar to activate those security features. Otherwise, one, how would they be a visible differentiator? And two, how would the registrar successfully upsell those services, those value-added services? So assuming that was part of their business model, which wouldn't necessarily be the case. But I do agree that, you know, there's a way to do this in such a way that addresses the needs of both ends of the spectrum. We talked about registrars not being uniform. Well, registrants are also not uniform. Some would have trouble removing even the simplest of lock features, and others require as many layers or different depths of security features as possible to protect valuable names. And I think that we shouldn't say that, you know, the groups from column A are having trouble understanding it, so we should remove the security features that are demanded by those from column B. And I think that we need to just be mindful of that.
Okay. Anybody else have anything to say on this before I throw another one of my 2 cents in there? No? Okay. Just my own perspective as both a registrar and as a registrant, we're getting some interesting thoughts and feedback here. I think maybe what Chris was saying, that we might need to have a look at splitting this into, you know, no response. In other words, that's it, boom, you know, the emails are bouncing, everything else. We have no way of contacting the registrar, so they're considered completely unresponsive. In terms of the ones who are actually going to respond, it would be easier probably if we could kind of decide on some parameters there. I would have a problem, for example, with the idea of 2 working days for the simple reason that they might be 2 of your working days. They might not be my 2 working days. because of, you know, bank holidays aren't the same internationally, so that, I could see that as being a problem. In terms of the differentiator, I'd agree 100% with everybody else on that one. In terms of the security measures, which people may not be aware of, the problem there is, where do you draw the line? We've had raging arguments with clients who refuse to carry out even basic validation because they think it's, quote-unquote, too much hassle. Yet I know for a fact that the same clients would have huge issues if their domains were transferred elsewhere without their permission. So where do you actually put the bar? I mean, do you want it to be so easy that, you know, we as registrars don't do anything to protect your domain names at all? We don't do anything to protect your accounts? Or will you accept that we need to do something, otherwise we're going to spend our entire lives being sued? Does anybody have any thoughts on that? No? James?
Yeah, Michele, you've hit it right on the head. This is a classic convenience versus security issue. We can make something easier, more convenient, more streamlined, but then it opens up vulnerabilities. And we've addressed this in the other IRTP group as well as this one, and I think that we just need to be mindful of that balance, of that trade-off, and adjust our any recommendations accordingly, respectful to both needs.
Okay, thank you. Mikey?
Yep, I'm with James on that. Also think that we've probably run into another fork in the discussion, because we've had a pretty extensive discussion about the unresponsive registrar, which I think is a great discussion, but I think it's a registrar-to-registrar unresponsive discussion and useful for our report. But on this particular issue, what we're really talking about is registrar to registrant and the visibility of the mechanism for the registrant to unlock a domain name. So I'm just highlighting another fork there. But I agree with you and James on the notion that, you know, it's a dilemma. It's a trade-off. You just have to pick a place and say, this is the degree to which we will not go beyond making it easy for registrants to unlock domains, because we don't want to let them hurt themselves. And we'll have to draw a line somewhere.
Okay, good, thank you. So in some ways what we're talking about here, Mikey, is that you have unresponsive registrar in terms of their relationship with the registrant, and unresponsive registrar in terms of registrar to registrar. Is that correct? Mikey? He's vanished.
Oh, sorry, it was a magnificent speech to the mute button. Sorry. I agree. This is the fork. Registrar to registrar is one side, and that's not really addressed by issue E. It's an important discussion, and we need to capture it and find a place to address it. But it's really the registrar to registrant relationship that's addressed in issue E.
Okay, Matt?
Yeah, just to pick up on what Mikey was saying, I mean, I don't know about the other registrars on the line, but generally when we're contacting a registrar, it's on behalf of the registrant. And we're doing so after the registrant has been unsuccessful in doing so directly. And so they come to us assuming, well, you're both ICANN-accredited registrars, so surely you must have a better way to be able to contact them and get information for us. So I don't necessarily know that it requires we sort of fork this off. I just think it's an understanding of the fact that the registrars that are contacting other registrars specific to these issues are doing so on behalf of the registrants, and also asking, frankly, that the registrar contact the registrant in order to resolve whatever the issue is.
Okay, perfect. Mikey?
Well, I don't disagree much, but I just want to highlight that I think the intent behind this issue when it was written was essentially to provide almost technical guidance to a registrar that says, "Dear registrar, you need to provide a gizmo for your registrants to be able to toggle this status." And that, you know, that's sort of one layer of the discussion. And if you don't provide it in a high, you know, difficult to define but important, readily accessible and reasonable means, then blah, blah, blah. And then there's the second half, which is when this doesn't work, either when it's not available or the registrant can't make it work, then the second half is the registrar-to-registrar conversation. And that, you know, we need to just understand that distinction, and we may have different approaches to solving those two parts of the problem.
Okay. I put myself in the queue as a registrar. I'd have to echo what Matt was saying. I mean, I've got one of my staff now who's probably who I'm going to probably be hounding for the next week as she tries to sort out the transfer of a domain for a client. And basically, because the registrant has tried to resolve the issue with the registrar and has hit a brick wall, so now we're trying to do it for them, because it's, even though, you know, it's not really our problem, in some respects it is our problem, because we're the only ones who are going to be able to solve this in the long run. So I'd agree with Matt. I mean, we can't really split the two off.
Oh, I don't want to split them off. I certainly don't want to lose it. I just want to highlight the fact that it's really a different kind of problem. One is sort of a standard setting. You know, the registrar to registrant one is really a standard setting sort of exercise that says, here's the threshold of what everybody ought to provide their customers. And then the second half is, here's the mechanism to address the situation that you and your staff person are in. And those are really quite different.
Okay. Does anybody else have anything, any other thoughts on that? No? Okay. Looking at the, where's that, the text, Marika provided the text on the chat, and I'll just read it out. This is from the registry stakeholder group, proposed modification for denial reason 7. I'll read this, it's quite long. Prior to receipt of the transfer request, the domain name was locked pursuant to the registrar's published security policy or at the direction of the registered name holder, provided that the registrar includes in his registration agreement the terms and conditions upon which it locks domains, and further, that the registrar provides a readily accessible and reasonable means for the registered name holder to remove the lock status. If the registrar does not provide a means to allow a registered name holder to remove the lock status themselves, then registrar must facilitate removing the lock within 5 calendar days of receiving a request from the registered name holder. It's on the chat there. From, I think most of you are on the Adobe thing. Does anybody have any comments on that suggested text? Mikey, again. Hold on, Mikey. Let's hang tough for a second. Does anybody whose name is not Mikey have any comments to make on this? No? Mikey, you have the floor.
I just wanted to amplify Michael Collins' point, which is, I don't think this is too bad. I mean, it's a pretty tortured sentence, and maybe we could make the sentence clearer. But I think that 5 days is probably a little long, given the pace of today's domain name world. That would be my only suggestion, is clarify the sentence a bit and shorten the interval.
But doesn't that contradict what you were saying previously on previous calls about slowing down the entire transfer process?
Yeah, but presumably this is a registrant-initiated lock that we're talking about in this particular case. So in this
No, that's not what was suggested in the text. The text was that there were two types of lock, either that the lock was something that the registrar did, but that they mentioned in their agreement, or it was a lock that was initiated by the registrant?
Right, you are. I stand corrected.
Okay. Anybody else apart from Mikey have any thoughts on that? Okay. Would you all? Michael Collins.
Sorry, I'm a little slow. The, this is Michael. I think reading that again, I think readily available and, well, I lost it now, readily accessible and reasonable means seems adequate to me after I've looked at it again. That may be sufficient for Dave and his team. Thank you.
Okay. Any other thoughts on that? David Giza?
Yeah. Thanks, Michele. So if we leave those terms undefined, then clearly compliance will exercise its judgment in terms of what reasonable and readily accessible means, which I'm fine with, provided that the community is okay with that as well. But I will tell you at the moment, we're probably relying more on the five calendar day time period as setting a sort of hard and fast compliant date. That gives us, again, the ability to issue a breach letter and basically threaten a non-compliant registrar into taking the appropriate action. So we're going to continue down that path. I would still recommend 5 calendar days just because of the complexities of communication as they exist today globally, as well as the fact that some registrars are just on the ball and they respond almost instantaneously, and others we find we can't reach them no matter how hard we try, and that's one of the reasons why we're conducting a registrar contact information audit this fiscal year, because we realize just how poor some aspects of registrar contact information or data is. But beyond that, if we don't define those terms, then they'll continue to have a bit of vagary and an ambiguity. But again, we can work within that context if that's what the working group wants us to do.
Okay, thank you. Anybody else have any other thoughts on this? Okay, rather than trying to get into anything further, because we're coming up to the hour, we've got about 5 minutes left, I would humbly propose that we call it a day. Do I have anything else on this? No, the next meeting, we're not meeting next week because next week is Constituency Day, so we should be meeting the week after, which is, if I understand it correctly, the 16th. Is that correct? Yeah, that's right, 16th. Does anybody have any other matters they wish to raise? Okay, then. For those of you traveling to Nairobi, have pleasant flights, and hopefully your bags will arrive there at the same time as you do. For those of you traveling to Renton or whatever it is, enjoy getting up and staying up all night. For those of you in Europe, we'll get to sleep in our beds at normal times and enjoy it. And I'll speak to you all in 2 weeks. Goodbye.
Thanks, Michele. Bye.
Thank you.
Thanks, Michele.